Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument, Eubank and others versus Pella. Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of all of the original class representatives in this case, save the lead counsel's father-in-law, because this is a settlement under which the attorneys are paid handsomely and the class essentially gets nothing. Class members in most cases are made worse off by the settlement because they release all of their claims against Pella, and what they get back in exchange for this relief, depends on what undefined subclass the class member falls in. But three of the eight subclasses only get a coupon, and as was pointed out at final approval, the discount on this coupon, which has restrictions, is comparable to or even less than what was made commercially available by Pella. The rest of the class essentially has to prove their case, and they have to do so in an arbitration proceeding under which there's no hope of fee shifting and under which their recovery is capped at $6,000. At the very least, we submit that these classes, because they're given such disparate relief under this deal, should have had actual defined club subclasses, as this court has recommended on numerous occasions. And each subclass, importantly, should have had representation. This was not done.
I have a question about that cap. Is the $6,000 cap applicable if the claimant has one window or 60 windows? It's not a per window cap.
No, absolutely not. It is an absolute cap, and that's the problem. I mean, Mr. Saltzman's claim, I think, was for two windows, and he valued it at $844. So someone with a larger house with a lot of windows is going to be affected by this. And moreover, if you just have an individual claim, and depending on what theory you plead and you bring it in court, you can take advantage of fee shifting. You don't have that in the arbitration proceeding. And given the defenses that Pella has raised and has given every indication it will continue to raise in these arbitration proceedings having to do with causation issues, as a practical matter, to prove the case, the class members are going to need to get an expert witness.
And is so, the $750 also per building rather than per window?
That is, as I understand it, also a cap. And then there are smaller numbers, and we lay this out in a chart in the brief, that are the per window and per sash caps. And so $750 is sort of the class member outside that they can get if they do the claims process. And even the claims can be charged.
There are, 150,000 class members?
I think that sounds right.
So they're saying that, well, at $1,000 a piece, you know, it's $150 million?
I think that there have been a variety of different attempts at valuation submitted. I think that may have been one of them, but as a practical matter, that's assuming a universal claims rate, which is
a universal
not,
what?
That everyone will submit a claim for the $750.
And will get some money.
Right, and obviously the way it's set up, as I understand it, Pella has the right to challenge all of these things, as they've traditionally done when people made warranty claims directly to them.
Is there any information on how many are likely to submit claims and how many of those claims are likely to be meritorious? Did the judge make an estimate of that?
There was nothing done in the district court.
He just accepted the $90 million?
We're not entirely sure what he did, to be honest. There's really no discussion of valuation in the final approval order or in the oral ruling at final approval. It was more of just sort of, this is my gut feeling about this case, and I'm going to go along with it.
Now, one of the things you said in your opening statement, you talked about this relationship between Saltzman and Weiss. And if Saltzman's relationship with Weiss was a per se conflict, why didn't anyone, including Mr. Lang, bring it to the court's attention earlier?
Earlier on, before there was a settlement, you mean, Your Honor?
Yes.
My understanding of Sussman and its progeny is that the problem is when that person is the only one carrying the water because there's nobody watching counsel. At that time, there were all of my clients who didn't have this relationship. I see I'm in my rebuttal.
So that wasn't a concern?
I think that at the time, because we had the Ehorns and we had Reva and we had Eubanks, that it was certainly less of a concern.
Well, let me ask you this. Given that an attorney in Illinois can act adversely to his client in a similarly related matter, do you see any conflict between Lang formally representing Saltzman and now trying to get him removed as a named plaintiff?
I don't believe so in this circumstance.
Why not?
He's still, I mean, at the time, his duty was to the class, and he is still acting in the interest of the class, and certainly of his other clients.
I just have one other quick question. You stated that the first mediator was fired. Where's the evidence in the record to reflect that fact?
In the briefing, you mean, Your Honor?
Yes, in the record.
I think...
It's in the briefing.
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I think that we provided a citation. If not, we'd be happy to supplement. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Frank.
Theodore Frank for Appellant Schultz. May it please the Court, Mr. Schultz did object to the relationship between Saltzman and Mr. Weiss.
At what point?
At the fairness hearing, in the course of filing an objection that was considered at the fairness hearing and summarily rejected.
Weiss is the son-in-law?
Weiss is the son-in-law of Saltzman.
Weiss is out, isn't it?
No, Weiss is still not
the case.
He is the lead counsel, and in fact, on page 131 of the appendix, under the settlements, he gets to allocate all $11 million of the attorney's
fees. What is the status of his sexual offenses?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
Has he been prosecuted for these things, or this is just a disbarment, or what?
My understanding is that there's a pending disciplinary hearing, and he denies the allegations. I don't know what the status of that is.
Is there any evidence in the record other than the inferential evidence that the ARDC proceedings against Weiss caused him to treat the settlement negotiations any differently?
The judge rejected that, and there wasn't any discovery into that particular issue. You asked about the claims rate, Your Honor, and after our opening briefs were submitted, pointing out that there had only been a little over 1,000 claims filed at the time of the fairness hearing, Pella submitted a new declaration in August of 2013 after opening briefs were filed, in this case, stating that there were a little over 10,000 claims filed for under the claims rate and just under 2,000 arbitration claims filed. If every one of those gets the maximum number, that adds up to just under $17 million. But, of course, nobody's going to get the maximum number. There's a per window cap, there's a per sash cap, and there's a per structure cap. And all of those are going to...
I'm sorry, the second cap after the window cap?
Sash.
Sash. Oh, for the sash, if the sash is damaged, the sash is defective.
And Pella retains dozens of affirmative defenses under the settlement with which they can challenge all of these things, especially, of course, at the arbitrations, where every individual class member is going to have to prove causation. And not only that, my co-appellant describes 8 subgroups, but when I look at the settlement, which is described at pages 10 through 12 of Pella's brief, you see a grid with 10 boxes and about 13 subclasses, the majority of which get no cash relief whatsoever. If you did not give prior notice to Pella before repairing your window, even if you file an arbitration, you get $0. The most you get is the pre-existing warranty program and a coupon. The judge did not consider the actual number of claims made. The judge made no findings of that, and I would submit under baby products, which I think this court should adopt, that's reversible error. We don't know what the actual relief to the class is. We know that there's a 12-page claim form which is bound to deter claims, and we know this because they brag that 30,000 people downloaded the claims, but only 12,000 filed them. And, of course, we're talking a class that's much greater than that. Then we get, of course, to the 23A4 issues. You have a settlement where the class representatives who agree to approve the settlement get an incentive payment, and the ones who oppose it do not. Under Radcliffe, that's per se improper. You have this relationship between the in-laws and in Rice versus Holt Household Bank. This court not only held that that was not, well, this court described it as per se improper, and then said this was evidence that this attorney should never be appointed class counsel ever again. So we have these 23A4 problems that were never considered. And in particular, it's just extraordinary. If the class representatives are to mean anything, that the vast majority of class representatives opposed the settlement. Maybe they were foolish to do so, but they did do so. And instead, the district court allowed them to appoint new class representatives after a settlement in principle is reached. Of course, these new class representatives are going to agree to the settlement because they wouldn't have been chosen in the first place if they opposed the settlement. And we have this sort of Potemkin class representation.
Who chose the class representatives?
Presumably class counsel did.
Did the judge make a determination whether they were appropriate?
The judge found that they were appropriate, but did not address Schultz's particular objection that the timing made it improper.
Now, this case was filed in 2006?
I think that's correct.
What has that's 8 years now. Why has it dragged on so long?
I'm just the objector and only recently came in at the appellate process. You would have to ask the parties. There was a 23F appeal, and that got appealed to the Supreme Court. And of course, settlement negotiations take whatever time they take. I'm into my rebuttal time. Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frank. Mr. Leon?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's worth refocusing ourselves to what we're here for, which is final approval. And the standard is whether the judge abused his discretion in approving the settlement under the ISBE factors. The
judge didn't seem to exercise any discretion. It's just a little meandering statement. I don't see any actual consideration of the issues.
Well, Your Honor, the judge did state that he had presided over the case for a long period of time.
Yeah, but there's no detail. There's none. There's just meandering. It's very hard to follow what he said.
I will admit that the opinion is not long.
Well, no, it's no good. It's not informative. It doesn't. You don't get anything out of it.
Well, you get his conclusions. Which
well, where do you get the $90 million from?
The $90 million was the valuation that was presented by class counsel.
Well, what did the judge say about the valuation?
He approved it.
Well, on what basis? What did he say about why he was approving it?
He didn't provide a statement as to why he adopted that valuation over a different valuation, but he did.
Well, that's not that won't do. The judge has to give judges have to give reasons for what they do.
Well, Your Honor, I'm just a lawyer here. I'm not obviously the judge.
I don't know what you mean when you say you're just a lawyer here.
Well,
I don't get anything out of that either.
Well,
I want to know what the judge said about why $90 million is an appropriate valuation. That's extremely important to whether an $11 million attorney's fee is appropriate.
Your Honor, he said, I find that the $90 million is the appropriate
value. And how did he find that? What did he add up? Did he look at all the claims? Did he look at the procedural rules and the arbitration? Do you look at the objections you can make or will make or have made? Does he discuss those things?
Does he
discuss those things?
He did not discuss those
things.
But the number is exactly the number that class counsel presented.
Well, according to your opponents, you've reserved the right to oppose all these claims in the arbitration proceeding. Is that correct?
We haven't.
You answer my question. Is that correct?
That Pella has reserved the right to challenge the claims in the arbitration process only as to the causation and damages issues, which were not certified. In other words, if this case were to be tried under this court's class certification opinion, only the liability issue would be resolved, and every single class member would then have to take that finding and go hire a lawyer and try a case and win causation and damages.
Given these barriers in the arbitration, given Pella's rights, how likely is it that the class members will recover $90 million?
Well, we have to sort of break down what the $90 million number is, but I submit that it's very likely that the class members who elected arbitration will win the arbitration.
That's not my question. You answer my question, not make up your own question and answer it.
Your Honor, the $90 million includes many things, not just the arbitration. A lot of the value of the settlement is driven by the extension of the warranty to year 2021.
All right, how much is that?
What
I would like to see is the $90 million broken down into its components to see whether there's any realism to the estimate.
It was presented.
Right? What are these warranties worth?
It was presented to the district court broken down in its components in detail. There was approximately $46 million of value ascribed to the extension of the warranty.
See, the problem is we can't just look at what was submitted to the district court and the calculation and then make a determination. We have to look at what the judge wrote, and there's no breakdown in what the judge wrote. So I don't understand how you get around Reynolds. I don't understand how you – there's no adding of categories, just like my brother Judge Posner said, and so you have huge problems with this order.
Your Honor, I admit that the order is short on words. It is short on words. But the number he adopted.
Yeah, but see, he has to explain why he adopted the number and why he rejected the other position.
Your Honor.
See, it's not enough to just adopt it.
If he adopted it exactly the number the class counsel presented, it was because he accepted the components of that number. And let's not forget, this was not a silly guess of a number. This was based on multiple regression analysis. It was presented to the court.
So is there anything in the record that demonstrates what percentage of the class members will receive the cap on damages?
Your Honor, there's no way to know that.
Right, and there's no comment by the judge on that. And I had one other question. Shouldn't we find it troubling that you were willing to pay $11 million in attorney's fees when you only valued the litigation at $14.5 million and the settlement at $16 to $24
million? Your Honor, we valued the settlement at $90 million. The claims have come in for the cash part. In other words, remember, this court certified two parts of this class, The first part were people who had already replaced their windows and were out-of-pocket damages. The second part were people who have windows which are either rotting in place or at risk of rotting in place in the future.
But the $14 million, that was the known number at the time the settlement was.
No, it was
wasn't
not.
Wasn't it?
We actually estimated that that number would be closer to $40 million. Now, the claims have come in. We know this now. The district court obviously couldn't know this because the claims period ran after final approval, which is a beneficial thing to the class. We know that the maximum claims, if everybody gets the $750 or the $6,000, is about $18 million. And if you add on top of that the $46
million... So why would you expect the maximum claims to be the claims actually awarded?
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the people who have opted for the $6,000 in arbitration are likely people whose damages actually exceed that amount, you know, by a fairly significant number. So even if there's some reduction as a result of causation defenses or damages, they're still likely to end up with the cap number. On the $750, all it takes is two or three windows to get you to that number, and it's likely that the people who don't want to go through the arbitration, and again, that's a choice. This settlement gave people a choice.
That's the kind of woolly analysis that you'd expect the judge to make.
Your Honor, this was all explained to the judge in significant detail. Significant detail. This was all information provided to the judge, and he specifically found that he thought, and he did say this.
You can't have a complicated case in which at the end the judge says, I agree with one side or another. He has to evaluate, I'm really just echoing Judge Williams, he has to evaluate the respective sides, you know, and explain why he credits one side over the other. It's not like a jury verdict.
Your Honor, there were three valuations that were presented to the district court. Two of them fully supported what...
No, but why didn't he explain why he was rejecting the objections, right? They're objections to your position. The judge could have said, I reject the objection because... But he never said anything like that.
Your Honor, obviously a court can always say more. And in this case, I admit, the opinion is brief. It's a three-page opinion. But there are other things that the court said along the way.
We're talking about tens of millions of dollars. You'd think the judge could spend, you know, an hour reading and explaining why he's letting this go forward.
Your Honor, what I do know is that there are really thousands of people who are waiting for this settlement to be distributed. And my reading, again, as a lawyer under the abuse of discretion standard, is did this opinion constitute an abuse of discretion? Could
so,
the judge
see,
not have reasonably...
Don't you get that we can't make that judgment unless we know the judge's thinking?
Your Honor...
And why the court adopted certain things?
The way I look at it is you look at what the judge said and what you say is, could a reasonable judge have reached that conclusion?
So then you're saying, let's just take this on summary judgment. You filed summary judgment motions before, right?
Of course.
Okay, so if the court, and let's say you're on the other side, you've also been on the other side of a summary judgment,
I have been both a plaintiff
and a
defendant.
So if the district court looked at the briefs and gave you a two-page order that said summary judgment is granted, summary judgment is granted. I've concluded that there are no material issues of fact, and that's it. Wouldn't you be running in here to appeal and say we don't understand why the court granted the summary judgment motion? We made all these very valid arguments, and the court never addressed them. It's a real problem. Wouldn't you do that?
Your Honor, I might. It really is dependent on what words were used in the short period of you know, two
I'm giving
pages.
You the words, just the summary. I'm giving you the words. I think this is the right thing to do.
Okay.
This makes sense to me.
I think the judge...
I mean, essentially, that's what the judge did.
I think he said much more than that.
Oh, yeah? What?
He
about
said...
$90 million.
The $90 million is one valuation number. What he explicitly said was that given the barriers that the members of the class faced to go forward with this litigation and not settle the case, that this settlement was in the best interests of the class. That's pretty clear.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Oh, yeah.
Mr. Van Orn.
Well, please, the court. I'm counsel for Pella, the defendant, and I would like to address three issues if my time allows. One issue is the structure of the settlement and the value provided. The second issue is why representation was adequate, notwithstanding Mr. Saltzman. And the third is what evidence there is to show that the district court did its job and what it was supposed to do. Let me begin with the valuation of the settlement. Pella submitted an expert affidavit at the preliminary approval stage and then supplemented at the final approval. The Judge Posner does exactly what Reynolds requires and breaks down the specific components both of the litigation value and of the settlement value. That is at page 30 and 31 of our supplemental appendix, and I'm happy to address any of the details of that. The valuation that Pella provided valued the litigation at approximately $14.5 million to the class, and the settlement in a range of approximately 17 to maybe 30 million to the class. Judge Williams, you asked why the settlement value is higher than the litigation value. The reason is that the litigation value doesn't include attorney's fees, and that's also measuring the value that would go to the class members in there rather than the value to Pella of settling. Of course, the value to Pella of settling is greater because it's getting rid of business disruption and because of risk aversion, and because it's avoiding its own attorney's fees. Reynolds held that the settlement needs to exceed the value to the class, otherwise it's not fair.
What were the page numbers you said your supplemental appendix?
It is pages 30 and 31, Your Honor, has the graphs and explaining exactly the flow of all of the individual benefits that come out of the settlement. Let me take 1 minute and just specifically address the caps and why those fit here and why they're sufficient. The structure of this is...
Is this supplemental appendix or is there something else?
No, it's bound together with our red brief.
Oh, in the red. I'm sorry. That's what you're saying, 30 to 31.
30 to 31 at the end of that.
Sorry.
Let me address the caps while you're getting there, and that is... In the claims process, which is the shorthand process that doesn't require any approval, and there were 10,700 claims submitted. In that process, there are caps by window and then $750 for the whole structure. The reason that's adequate is because that is just out-of-pocket costs that haven't already been covered. Remember, people who are submitting through that have already been covered by the warranty, which covered replacement parts. And so what the settlement is covering is just the excess for labor installation. What the record shows is because there's only at most a 3.7% replacement rate, it's unlikely that most people will have any more than one or maybe two windows that suffer this, even if they have a lot of windows in their house. And under that, the $750 is more than adequate to cover the out-of-pocket cost to install this, which the record shows. That, I think, is why the claims process showed so many people chose claims rather than arbitration. For the relatively small number of people who had more windows or had more problems or maybe it affected the other parts of their house, the $6,000 covers that. There aren't any per window or per other caps within the $6,000. You could get all the way up to $6,000 on one window if it affected the structure around that. Relatively few people are going to have that kind of out-of-pocket cost, again, given the warranty that covers replacement parts. That's why there are only about 1,500 claims there. And given the class size, Your Honors, is approximately 6.4 million. That's an estimate based on the number of windows sold. If you assume a 10% failure rate of that, which is far higher, that would be about 64,000. Half of that, 5%, would get you to about 32,000. And if you get down, you would expect a claims rate approximately like what you got here to fully satisfy the few people who actually had injuries.
That arbitration process seems like a pretty intimidating course to take for the average claimant, I would think.
Your Honor, I don't think so. But I mean, we know we don't have to estimate how this would depress claims rates or anything. We know the claims period is now closed. There were about 1,500 arbitration claims submitted, which is about what you would expect, I said, given the failure rates here. And what my opponents didn't mention is that the class settlement gives people the relief of actually having prevailed on liability. These were consumer fraud claims, but they don't have to prove that there is a misrepresentation. They don't have to prove they relied on it. And they don't have to prove there's a defect. The settlement makes that very, very clear. It says they don't have to do it. That's at page 125 of the big appendix. It says that quote. And so all they have to do is prove pure comparative fault. And so they're given the advantage of having won on the legal claims that are very weak, and you just get down now to, does this defect cause the damages? And if they show that...
Well, are you expecting to be represented by a lawyer or just... handling this themselves.
Judge Zagel found that he believed that most people could do it without a lawyer. And if you read through the claims forms, it, because there aren't any legal elements left, consumer misrepresentation, omission, it's just, did this defect cause this problem? He believed that it wasn't necessary. If people find it necessary, they can do it. My time's already up, Your Honors, but I've addressed one of the...
No, you should talk, you should address the issue of... Saltzman's relatives.
Yeah. Our position on that is, regardless of what this court holds with respect to Mr. Saltzman himself, the representation was adequate during the entire time because
there I don't think it matters.
Because there are always
others. I don't think it matters. I don't think you can have relatives of the class representative being lawyers in a class action.
And, Your Honor, Pella isn't defending the choice there. I can tell you the reason.
Yeah, I think it destroys the whole class action.
Let me correct one factual part about the process here that my opponents just got wrong. And that is, they said, no one disputes, by the way, that representation was adequate among the parties up until the four Eubanks objectors
left. That is not the issue. You have a built-in conflict of interest in every class action between the class counsel and the class. The class counsel wants fees, and the defendants want to minimize their overall liability. And they don't care how the class revenues are split between the lawyers and the class members. That's why serious review of class action is necessary for district judges to do and not rubber stamping. But given this inherent conflict, you can have a situation where the class representative is a relative of the class counsel.
Your Honor, Pella isn't defending Mr. Saltzman. Our position is
well,
that
then
the
you're
other...
you're not defending the class action, I don't think.
No, what we're defending is there are always other representatives and always other counsel.
I don't see what difference that makes. All the representatives have, as I said, is an inherent conflict of interest between class counsel and the class. Because the class doesn't control the class counsel. Well, but you have a representative now. A representative is supposed to exercise some sort of control over class counsel. One of these representatives is deeply tainted. Now, the other representative, do they care? Not clear they care.
Well, the other representatives were approved by the district court, and this is the factual point
that
I wanted.
He approved Weiss.
This is the factual point that I wanted to make later on.
I mean, you not only have him appointing his, son-in-law?
Yes.
This is Weiss.
So, you're on the...
This guy has a big taint.
At the time...
All his sexual business.
At the time that this was raised, the objectors say that the alternative representatives were added after the settlement was reached just to basically be patsies to affirm this. And that is just factually incorrect. The additional representatives were added because Pella argued and moved to the district court that there had to be representatives for each subclass. And the district court agreed with that, and it ordered that additional representatives
well,
be
who
added.
Who picked the representatives?
Well, the counsel who is now objecting to their inadequacy, Mr. Lang. And that was ordered on May 5th, which is docket 228. The order came out while the parties were in the first of several mediation sessions, and so the additional representatives were ordered to be there before settlement negotiations happened. And that's May 5th, docket 228. And then they were moved for admission in October, again, before the settlement was completed. That was docket 245. And Mr. Lang, who's now objecting, and the Eubanks objectors, told the district court that they thought they were adequate. So that was the one factual point that I want to make. Let me turn.
What was Schultz's position?
Pardon me?
What was Schultz's position?
Mr. Schultz came in later. So this is all happening in 2011. Mr. Schultz came in 2012. His view was that, you just heard Mr. Frank argue, is that these new class representatives were added after the settlement was completed to be patsies. And he's factually inaccurate on when they were added, and he's factually inaccurate about why they were added. They were added because Pella moved to require it, and the district court ordered it, and that all happened before settlement. Mm-hmm.
In your appendix at 30 and 31,
yes.
I think it's 30 and 31, there's a breakdown of the assumptions using the settlement calculation, and
That's correct. Made
reference to this October 15th preliminary approval hearing.
Yes.
And the order of the court, did the court go through each objection and say why he thought these numbers were appropriate in that preliminary?
Judge Zagel did not show his work.
Okay. Were there further objections filed once he did this preliminary approval hearing?
Your Honor, the way this worked is that Pella put in its analysis at the preliminary approval hearing right up front. And then after it put its analysis, there were two sets of briefing after that where everyone briefed it.
Yes, so that's why I'm trying to see why you think this saves you, this document. Because, the document was proposed by Pella. The objections were not all in. That's why I wanted to find out, were there any kind of objections? Typically, it's not.
Yes.
When you put it in. So there were no objections made. So all these objections that were made after, and that's our point, that the court didn't go through them.
No, Your Honor, that's not quite accurate in terms of the sequence. Pella put it in its brief at the preliminary approval, and then the objectors filed briefs after that and before the preliminary approval hearing that did object to that.
Okay, and so what I want to find is the judge's reasoning for when the a preliminary approval hearing was held, and you're saying he didn't share that with you.
It's
not in writing anywhere.
The only thing there is a transcript at preliminary approval. It's in the appendix at pages 271 to 79.
And my question is, in that appendix, did he go through each category and make a comment?
No, certainly not. The thing he did is, the objectors, by the way, also did a settlement valuation. That's in their brief here, where the litigation value ended at $308 million. As I pointed out, they didn't have an expert. They didn't have evidence. They made arbitrary assumptions on the probabilities. They made up the failure rates. And so what Judge Zagel found, and this is a quote from page 273 of the appendix at the preliminary approval hearing, he said that the objectors' valuations are not, in fact, realistic at all. So he considered theirs and rejected them, which was utterly appropriate. He then commented about Pella's valuations, and he didn't go through these categories of the affidavit. You can't claim that he did. He didn't say it. He didn't write it down. But what he said is he looked at Pella's valuations, and he said, given that the valuation of this settlement is uncapped, Pella will keep paying and paying as long as claims come in. He said that really showed that Pella had a high degree of confidence in its valuation. So he did that. The last point that I was going to say, to the extent that Judge Zagel showed his work, we cite in our briefs the Weinberger decision, which is a decision by the Second Circuit by Judge Friendly. And he faced a situation very similar to this where the final approval order was 2 pages long. And obviously, it didn't contain a lot of reasoning, but it referenced this. And he said the approval order showed that the judge had thought about this. It didn't show all the work, but given that and the sufficiency of the record, he thought, for the fairness of the parties, that was sufficient. What Judge Zagel did is he held 5 substantive hearings in connection with approval. First, before preliminary approval was submitted at all, he held an entire hearing on the conflict of interest where he heard testimony on this.
What did he say about the Saltzman-Weiss business?
What he got to the end of the hearing, and what he commented is that he thought that some of this had come out of the disagreements between plaintiff's counsel as they were dissolving their firm. And he thought that...
I don't see the relevance of that to Saltzman and Weiss.
Well, and he commented on what he thought the credibility was of the Mr. Lange allegations. He didn't directly say anything, Your Honor, about the relationship between Mr. Saltzman and Mr. Weiss. What he ultimately did is, because of the existence of the other adequate class representatives, he deferred ruling on the validity of the settlement at all till the preliminary approval hearing when he could have the valuations. And ultimately,
he didn't say anything? He didn't think there was anything peculiar about the relationship?
He didn't put anything either in a transcript or a ruling, Your Honor, on that. So it's just not there.
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Van Oort.
Thank
and,
you.
Mr. Oppenheim or Mr. Frank, do you have anything further?
Okay, I just have a couple seconds. I just, in listening to the argument, I've reminded that this court has often said in numerous cases that lack of explanation is often sufficient in itself to constitute an abuse of discretion. That's really, I think, what we're dealing with here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rockman. Mr. Frank?
I want to correct some things. There are two sets of objectors here. There's the Lange objectors who were participating in the preliminary approval hearing, and then once there was preliminary approval, my client got notice and objected later on. The Pell evaluation that is attached to their red brief is for $25 million, and it assumes that everybody who has an injury will file a claim and the claim will be granted. It doesn't address the baby products issue that we raised in our objection. It doesn't address the fact that there were only 12,000 claims made. And even if we assume that each of these claims is adequate and compensates people for their damages, even if everybody gets the maximum, that's $17 million. But we know people aren't going to get the maximum because some of them are capped at zero because they never made an application to Pella or they don't have evidence of their application to Pella. Some of them are going to have only one window of damage and be capped at $100 or $175 or $200. And some of them have damages of less than $6,000. And you add it all up. He says, well, the 10,000 claims is what we'd expect. But then that's a capped valuation of $8 million for the class and $11 million for the attorneys. And this settlement could have been structured in a way that the class got more than the attorneys.
Well, your opponents are emphasizing the value of the warranty extension.
And the problem there is already a warranty extension before there was a litigation, the litigation complaint.
Oh, you mean PESA?
The PSEP, I think, is the...
Sorry.
You can't take credit for something the defendant was already doing. And that's black letter law. That's Reynolds in this case. That's Drymax Pampers had the same problem where they had a refund program, but the refund program was already in effect. That's section 3.13 of the ALI Principles of Aggregate Litigation. If the defendant is already doing something and you put it in the settlement, you can't say, aha, look at all this value we created. And even all that value is $5.5 million. It doesn't get us to a proportionate valuation. They complain that, well, the judge couldn't have made these findings because the claims approval deadline was after the fairness hearing. And, Your Honor, I submit to you that everybody does that precisely so that they can come in with these exaggerated estimates. Oh, this is going to be $90 million, and then the judge never finds out how many claims are actually made. And I've never seen somebody accidentally underestimate the number of claims. You always see these claims process set up so that they come after the deadline, and then the objectors come in and say nobody's going to make these claims because there's a 13-page claim form, and then they say, well, we're estimating here. And then the judge never comes back and sees whether that estimate happens. And it never does. In my dozens of objections, on the occasions when a judge does come in and say, well, let's postpone the fairness hearing and see where the claims come in, suddenly, surprised, the claims are a lot less than everybody predicted.
Wait, I've lost the thread. You say they offer their claims estimate before the claims are filed?
What happens is that they deliberately structure the settlement so that the fairness hearing is before the claims deadline.
Oh, the fairness hearing is before the claims deadline. That's what you're
saying. And then they tell the judge, well, we don't know how many claims there are going to be, but we expect a lot of claims later. There aren't that many claims now, but we expect a lot of claims later. And then there never are. And in this case, we never would have found out that there were only 12,000 claims, except we mentioned in our opening brief, and Pella rushed to the district court to file a new affidavit after our opening brief was on file to say, oh, see, there are 12,000 claims. And even that number doesn't get you to an $11 million attorney fee. I'm happy to answer any other questions this court may have.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the plaintiffs' counsel as well. We'll move on.